Welcome to Special Sauce, the Serious Eats podcast about food and life.
Such bad food at my mom's table and so little of it.
Wait, that's going to be on your tombstone.
It is going to be on my tombstone.
Back with us is the funny, funny, and deeply personal writer Jenny Allen, the author of the new book, Would Everybody Please Stop? Reflections on Life and Other Bad Ideas. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because you have created one-woman plays and do audio storytelling on The Moth and write, and you really are a quintuple threat.
I wish, like, but go on. Thank you.
Is there a common thread that runs through whatever you do?
Yeah, me, 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 me. Yeah, and
so
here's something else about
me. It's a narcissism.
Oh, totally.
But it's a benign narcissism. It's not a malignant narcissism.
It's not the malignant narcissism of some of our public elected officials. I hope it's not narcissism. I hope it's self-reflection. I hope it's, you know, wonderful Joan Didion said it. Or was it my Moth producer who said it always has to be about you? Maybe both of them. That is, not that it's self-centered, but it has to come, at least my writing has to come from the only frame of reference that I seem to know, which is me. And, you know, sometimes I wish that I had an expertise that gave me a broad frame of reference. Like, you're a personal writer as well, you, Ed, but you also actually know a huge amount about a subject. And I don't know, I've talked about this with my, you know, writer friends as well. I often wish that I had some subject that I knew about that I could speak with any authority. I just can't think of one, really.
Yeah. Well, to me, what the common thread is, the stories are human, funny, and truthful.
I hope so.
And they are about you, but you're trying to make a point about how does everyone keep on keeping on?
Yes, that is really true. That is our work, isn't it, as human beings?
Yeah.
We just have to keep on with the business of life.
Yeah.
As insane and overwhelming and often discouraging as it is.
Yeah.
And chaotic as it is. Yes.
Sure.
I think you've put it. I wish I could. I wish I'd thought of that phrase.
Just you can use it.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you.
So everyone who wants and needs a laugh right now, and who doesn't, given what we're living through, should read Would Everybody Please Stop? Why and how did the book come about?
Well, I've been doing these pieces for The New Yorker. I write many more than they publish. They don't accept them all. And some of them, they want for the website, but not the print magazine. And some they don't want at all. And some I sell elsewhere, although there's not too many elsewheres to sell them now.
Yeah.
Some, you know, some I really thought were funny, but they didn't. But I've been writing these for a while. And my old friend, she was an acquaintance. Now she's become my dear friend. I feel that way. A woman named Sarah Crichton, who has her own imprint at Farrar Straus, asked me if I wanted to do a book of these pieces. And of course I was jumped up and down. And she said Jonathan Galassi liked my writing, so he was on board with that.
And he's the editor-in-chief or the publisher.
Exactly. So that was pretty great. On some level, I thought to be in The New Yorker at all had been more than I had ever could have asked for. I didn't really expect that in my life. So it was, in one way, kind of enough for me just to be in print and have people read it, things that I thought, again, would never live outside my own brain. And I felt quite lucky that way. The book took longer than it probably should have. That is,
it was more than just putting together the pieces.
Oh, my God.
People think when you read these kinds of books, so she just took the pieces and she scrunched them all together.
Oh, would that that were true. Would that that were true. I mean, we toiled on this and I wrote many new pieces for it. I wrote many pieces that weren't quite funny enough, although Sarah would always put it in such a tactful way.
And then would she, you know what my producer, says, Marty Goldenson. Yeah. When I used to send him copy for my radio pieces at WNYC, he'd say, this is good, but you need to make it 15% funnier.
Well, oh, God, that's great. Yeah, some of them I did try to make 15% funnier, and just didn't work. I mean, some of them, again, with humor, that it's kind of a brutal thing in a way, because it's either 15% funnier or you weren't able to pull it off. I wrote a lot more. Some of them are in the book, some are not. We wanted it, and she also asked for some personal essays in there. Some of them had been published, and I wrote a lot more, or some more, for that. Mm-hmm. And they all had to be kind of, there wasn't a narrative, that's for sure, but they had to seem to come from the sort of mind of a woman at a certain point in life.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that didn't, we didn't use.
Yeah, sure. So, of course, I gravitate to the stuff on food because that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And the chapter called Seconds made me cry. I laughed so hard. I love this thing you wrote. I graduated from college eventually, but that excitement about eating has stayed with me every single day of my adult life.
Yes.
Three times a day, more if I feel like it. I can choose things I like to eat and eat them in peace. I never take this freedom for granted. I never get tired of it. I never don't anticipate eating with pleasure.
That is absolutely true. Even on my way over here, yum, yum, bagel. What is the everything bagel? My favorite, because I live on Martha's Vineyard now. You can't reliably get an everything bagel. Oh, and I mean, even when I had cancer, I think I was disappointing to people because, you know, not really, but people would say, oh, you must really not want to eat at all. How's your appetite? Say, great. I'm starving. I mean,
I remember there's lots of riffs about food in the play, which I loved, of course.
Yes. Oh, yes. There are riffs about food. There is. Yes. There's the making of.
Yeah.
There is. I mean, I did. It wasn't chemotherapy that killed my appetite. Nothing can, it seems, kill my appetite. I'm always hungry and I'm always delighted to just chow down. But after I had cancer, I had these side effects, which were that my legs just killed me all the time. It's a little unclear. Many other cancer patients complain of this, whether, I don't know what it is. They were just very achy. And if I stood on them for any length of time, that was a misery. So I couldn't really stand at the stove. I still had kids at home at that time, or one child at home, and I felt very bad about that I couldn't cook, and bad about, I keep trying to write about this as well, although it seems so mean-spirited, but I wished that, you know, I did have plenty of friends whom I adore, but the MO of Manhattan culture is not to bring somebody a casserole, and I remember standing there thinking, man, if it's not our culture here in Manhattan to, could somebody please bring something to eat to my house, please? You know, my sister lives in Silver Spring, and if you get sick or a parent dies,
they bring over a casserole.
Oh my God, there's a food tree, and they bring over a casserole and leave it on your doorstep if you don't want to come to the door, and it is just not our culture.
Yeah, it's true.
A couple of people did do that, and I was so grateful, including, out of nowhere, my former husband's former wife, a woman who had never wished me ill as far as I knew, but we really weren't buddies. She'd called one day, and she had never been known as a cook. In fact, sort of a little notorious for that she never cooked. She had light and lively American cheese in her refrigerator. That was it, and a little skim milk. She brought over this most incredible chili every couple of weeks for months. And that was I did turn it into a little story called Judy's Chili. That was a book that I did with my ex-husband, a sort of fables for grown-ups.
Right.
That was really the gift that was just out of nowhere. She would show up, this woman who, again, as far as I knew, hadn't been cooking for 40 years, never had cooked. She could never tell us what was in it. I'd say, Judy, this is so delicious because my kids loved it. And what's in it? Well, I don't know what's in it. She would just, I always was afraid I was going to find, you know, like a shoelace in it or something, because she was so, it was just fascinating to me that she would do this. She, who was quite a cosmopolitan person, not a suburban, you know, or rural sort of let's bring you a turkey tetrazzini, that she of all people would do this me this great abundant kindness. Anyway.
Yeah. So there are a lot of things you write about food in the book, and I just want to ask you about some of the statements, some of the declarative sentences.
Yes, please.
I like paying for food. I like the cleanness of that exchange.
I do.
Like, please expand upon that.
Well, I guess I think this probably has to do with my, maybe with my mother, and sort of feeling like I was supposed to be, we were all supposed to be beholden to her for having made a meal.
Right.
Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for feeding us again.
So a restaurant meal, there's no baggage.
No baggage. I pay you. Yeah. And I think I talk in that piece a little bit about, I mean, I like the impersonality of it. I even love Torn and Hardart.
you wrote about that fresh ham sandwich, which
I
loved.
Oh, my God, the best ham sandwich. That was a
pristine moment. And Horn Hardart, we should explain to people who might not know, it was also called the Automat, because all the food was behind these little windows, and you put coins in the slots, and then the window would open, and a ham sandwich would magically appear.
Oh, it was so exciting. And remember the coffee spigots? That they had these... I was reminded of them. The coffee came out of the wall too, but they had these wonderful kind of swan, they were brass spigots in the shape of some kind of animal's head that was kind of elegant. And I like paying for it. I do. I do.
And you also write about being nervous about not getting enough to eat.
Yeah.
And you think that also goes back to the family table?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think we ever knew when dinner was coming. I think there always was dinner. Such bad food at my mom's table and so little of it.
Wait, that's going to be on your tombstone.
It is going to be on my tombstone. Oh, my God.
There was such bad food at my table and so little of it.
The idea that food, it is, and again, the growing up is a great antidote, being an adult.
Yeah.
That there's, to me, the idea of plenty is very important. That, and I know that I've been accused many times, I've gotten a little better, of overloading people's plates. I do that.
But that was an antidote.
That was an antidote.
Yeah.
And I get sad when I look in people's refrigerators, iceboxes, although I'm sure we are the last generation to do that, to look in their icebox and see nothing in there makes me sad. It gets me a little, if I'm staying at their house, I get a little panicky, although I do try to contribute food, but
right.
I can't even imagine living that way where the refrigerator isn't just full of something, of there's going to be something good enough in there to eat. I don't like to, here's something that makes me really anxious, traveling without, where I'm at the mercy of, or in some situation where I'm going to be for many hours, where I may not have something to eat.
You tell that story about driving from the Vineyard with friends and you didn't know their eating habits.
So
while
worried
traveling.
About that.
That's hilarious.
Yes, I had to bring food with me. But anything, I get very cross if I'm invited to do, a kind of meeting, say, a day-long meeting.
Right.
That it makes me very anxious. Our meeting's starting at 9:00. And there's no donuts there. Not that I adore donuts. That's just wrong.
Right.
There should be food when you get there for this day-long meeting. They should tell you when lunch is. And They should give you a little something in between, a little coffee break in between.
And one of the things that annoys you in the book, you say, please don't invite me to an art opening with the only food being peanuts.
I get very angry about that. I can't believe you even read remembered that.
But I feel the same way.
I resent it. Terrible. How hard it is to get a little cheese and crackers there. Is that really going to break your budget? I hate that. I went to something. Oh, my God, Ed, it was like a... Oh, God, it's all coming back to me as a hideous, hideous nightmare, but it really happened. I went to some thing last summer, not on Martha's Vineyard, at another sort of summer community. And it was, for all I believe to be true, kind of one of those pretty waspy communities not known for their cuisine. And it was, yes, okay, it was a cocktail party, but it was a fundraiser. Somebody brought me to this. I didn't pay
right.
money. I was the plus one.
But somebody paid money.
Somebody paid money for this. It was somebody's house to raise money for something. And we get there, and there are drinks aplenty. Drinks. And not a scrap to eat at this party. But somebody, again, my acquaintance who brought me, had spent some untold sum to attend this cocktail party. And it was at somebody's house. There wasn't not even peanuts at the bar, nothing. And I thought, this cannot be. We must have missed the food, even though we're not really late. It was from 6 to 8. We got there at 6:30. Maybe they devoured all the food. So I made it my business to go through the entire downstairs of this large house looking for the food. And, because I simply couldn't believe it, and that they would charge money for this party.
That's hilarious.
And but... there wasn't anything. There had never been any food. I went to the kitchen. I couldn't believe it. There was no person in the kitchen, like with the last pieces of, Triscuits and deviled eggs. There wasn't anything.
That's weird. You know what I would have done?
What? Please tell me.
If my wife was with me, as you know, she was the most polite person.
The most polite person in the
world, mm-hmm. I would have ordered pizza.
That's a brilliant idea.
Right? In fact, I've done that. One time I was with a bunch of chefs in Chicago, and we went to this restaurant, and the food was just terrible, and we were all hungry, so I ordered pizza delivered to the restaurant.
Brilliant. Did they let it in the door?
They were very unhappy. That guy's become a really important chef, but I don't care.
No, we were
hungry.
They would probably have been there. I'm sure there must have been other people like me who might have just devoured it.
Yeah.
But pizza was perhaps a little ethnic for that setting. Yeah. Oh my God! Not even a box of Triscuits.
That's hilarious.
The wasp standby.
You also write that the person that invented Tums should get a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
Please expand upon that.
I have to say, I didn't. Now that was a kind of conceit of mine. That's called from a piece called Me Flirting, I think, which is a middle-aged woman trying to flirt with somebody at a wedding. And that isn't actually, that's not really actually.
Right, it was fanciful.
It was a little fanciful. But and this woman thinks, because I do enjoy writing pieces from the point of view of a woman much like me, but totally clueless
right.
about how she's coming across. She thinks everybody likes her. She thinks she's doing great. And she thinks this guy kind of likes her, too. All she does is talk about all her physical aging, her
right.
attributes. Now, I do own Tums. I do have some at my home. I don't have any, for example, though, in my purse. I don't really have indigestion as often as the woman in that piece. But I... But they are kind of a miracle if you are suffering from
yes.
from
and
that malady, they will cure it.
So let's take this to its illogical extreme.
Please.
Let's compare in a food critic's way.
Yes.
Tums, Rolaids, and Pepto-Bismol.
Oh, Pepto-Bismol. Man, I haven't had that since I was a kid.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a Tums person.
I think Tums, and also Tums has this sort of flavor one that doesn't really taste too terrible that you can sort of chew in your mouth.
Yeah, like the fruit ones. And there's
the fruit ones.
there's diversity. There are many colors.
There are many colors and a convenient container for the fruit ones. I do have that one in my car between, you know, right near the driver's seat in case I'm just tempted to eat way too much, which I often am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a poignant essay in the book about what it's like to live alone, and you write about the joys of eating alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's something that people don't normally associate joy with.
Yeah.
And I don't think it has to do with age. I think it has to do with, it's almost we're programmed not to enjoy eating alone.
Isn't that funny? Yes. I mean, I do know, well, I think maybe particularly, I think it's still true. A lot of women are shy about going out to eat alone.
Mm-hmm.
They think they look needy or sad, or they just feel unprotected or something.
Yeah.
I don't feel that way, although I don't really take myself out to fancy restaurants.
Right.
I love to go to coffee shops.
You love to go to coffee shops and have the turkey burger.
Oh, my God, with a little Swiss cheese on it. Newspaper.
You need the Swiss cheese because, let's face it, most turkey burgers suck.
I know. You do. Yeah, the turkey, yeah. It's a big step up from the veggie burger, though, Ed, isn't it?
That's for sure.
That gummy veggie burger.
I have to say, this is a little bit of self-promotion for Serious Eats, but Kenji Lopez-Alt's veggie burger, his black bean burger, and his turkey burgers, which titled Turkey Burgers That Don't Suck,
are amazing. Those are terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is the ingredient?
Marmite. He loves Marmite,
really?
and anchovies because they add umami, you know, that sort of ultimate savory flavor.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, anyway, it's just a little aside.
Very good to know. And the black bean burgers, that sounds delicious, actually, if they're done right.
Yeah.
Although I do love a great hamburger and engage now with my...
Well, we have those covered in spades.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
So,
I understand.
You have two amazing daughters.
Aww.
One is kind of a triple threat like you.
No,
actor,
she's one of those people who really did seize the day.
Actor, playwright, television writer. How is she different than you? And do you think it's a matter of upbringing? Is it generational? Have you tried to give her any advice about career or life?
I never give her advice unless she asks for it.
And, you know, we should say that she was in The
Mothers.
Squid and the Whale.
Yeah.
She was on Broadway in The Front Page. She had a play that was produced, or her name is Hallie Pfeiffer. And she's quite extraordinary.
She is an extraordinary person and a really good person.
I mean, so is her mom.
No, you're sweet to say so, but she... That's what I'm really proud of, that she is, and her sister as well. These are, and I'm not just saying that, you know, I don't care if they're a lumberjack or a, you know, dog catcher. They are very good people.
They have great generosity of spirit and heart.
They have generous spirits. They have big hearts. Hallie is very good at managing her life, which I admire. I mean, I learn a lot from her. She is what I was just laughing about before. She was going to be an actress and a playwright since she was a...
toddler.
Yeah. I mean, when she was young, she said once she was a child, she said, "I want to be a child actor." I mean, and we didn't let her do that whole agent thing until she was much older, and we said, you know, no commercials, and we're not going to move to L.A. So her opportunities were limited for a time. And her father was a playwright, and she, I think, grew up going to the theater, but she didn't wait for 30 years as her mother did to sort of give herself permission to be an artist. She had embarked on that in, you know, high school and playwriting and acting, and she didn't think she had to be a card-carrying member of the establishment forever before she could write something that was for herself or creative or take that risk. So I admire that very much about her.
And she's comfortable blazing her own path.
She is.
Do you think that she's embarked on a life that you wish you would have started earlier?
Oh, for sure. Yes, and I do love that about her. I want somebody to write a book, not me, but I do think a lot about my friends and their daughters, and often see that their daughters seem to be kind of carrying on much has been written about fathers and sons, but mothers and daughters in terms of their work. I feel like among my friends, more than several of our daughters are doing the things that we do, only sooner, better, braver. It's just wonderful to watch. I don't feel that she's an extension of me.
No.
At all, because she really isn't. I love her fearlessness. If she were here, she'd be the first person to say, Mom, don't say that. I'm afraid all the time, every day. But she is so self-aware, and so she doesn't have the, and she's not alone in this. I think her friends are like this too, I seem to notice. The ambivalence about her own ambition,
mm-hmm.
she doesn't suffer with that.
Yeah.
She enjoys that.
Yeah.
She owns it, like they say. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so we're just about ready for the special sauce All You Can Add's buffet, but now I'm taking a page out of Reddit, and you can ask me anything. Is there anything you want to ask me?
Oh, Ed Levine?
Yeah.
Oh, Ed Levine. Okay, all right. Well, is this too corny to ask you who you have at your dinner party? Have you answered that too many times?
All
right. You have. Can you come up with a new one?
But I'm going to think about it, and okay. I'm going to ask you the questions at the buffet.
Okay.
So who's at your last supper, no family allowed? Can be living people, dead people?
I do love this question. All right. So I'm thinking Frank McCourt.
Frank McCourt.
Because
Angela's Ashes.
Love the way he writes about food.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and not having enough.
Right.
Remember, I'll never forget licking the newspaper to lick the oil off the fuzz of the fish and chips came
book.
In that.
Yeah.
Amazing book about food. And I met him a couple of times. And you know, when I met him, I had my daughter with me, Julie, my other daughter, who was about five or six. And I wish I could do an Irish accent. He leaned down. He said, He said, hello, Julie, and what did you have for supper? Just right away. I just love that, because it was so Frank McCourt. Anyway, okay, Frank McCourt we have to have. And I think Eleanor Roosevelt, although I have been reading about the book about the women and food. What is the name?
The Laura Shapiro book,
Great idea for a book with Eleanor, I wouldn't invite her as a foodie.
Yeah.
But I'd love to eat with her. And I'd love to eat with Lori Colwin.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful writer, fiction writer, but also wrote for Gourmet and loved to eat and loved to cook. And
was a wonderful.
And so funny and human. Yeah.
I never met her, but I always wanted to. And I think I make roast chicken because of Lori Colwin.
Yeah.
Because she did a whole ode to roast chicken.
All right, I like this table. There's one more person.
Oh, I can have one more person?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I was thinking. Okay, hold on a second. I think Matisse.
Matisse.
I would like to have Matisse. Yeah.
He's the only guy at the table. He's amazing.
He's amazing, and I just.
And he's so much about joy and light.
Yes, he is. Matisse or maybe Banksy. I want to ask, I have a few questions for Banksy.
All right, that's good. That's good. So what are you eating?
Oh my gosh, I haven't thought about that.
Yeah.
I'm cooking?
No, you don't have to be cooking.
Oh, well, lamb chops.
Okay.
Delicious lamb chops.
Loin or shoulder?
Loin.
Okay.
And then we're going to have corn pudding.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
And just a really good green salad.
Okay. And dessert?
Well, you know, I like to bake cakes.
Yes, you're an excellent baker.
Thank you, Ed.
Your pineapple upside down cake. I know you're not fishing for compliments. Go ahead.
The other day I made a pineapple ginger upside down cake.
That sounds delicious.
That was, I have to say, pretty good.
Yeah.
And Also, pineapple chocolate upside down cake is also good. I do like those upside down cakes. But maybe I would make, I'm not just sucking up to you right now, but there was a cake, because I've gotten obsessed with baking cakes, and I was going to just say coconut cake here, which I like to make, but there was a cake in Serious Eats recently. Who was the chef? The illustration just, I was in heaven. Chocolate cake, a layer cake with a kind of raspberry frosting, a sort of pink raspberry frosting with raspberries all over it. I think maybe I would make that cake.
Got it. Okay. So
it's 7-minute icing.
Seven-minute icing.
My sister used to make that too.
So what is your guilty pleasure? Do you have one? Or do you have any?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, food, we should say.
Chocolate, dark chocolate covered almonds. And if I can't find those... It's the Mounds Bar is the dark chocolate.
The Mounds Bar is one of the greatest things in the world.
And sometimes I forget and buy Almond Joy by mistake.
And that's such
That's
a terrible mistake.
It's a terrible mistake.
So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Okay. Well, pasta.
Pasta.
Or eggs. Maybe a little omelet if there's anything to put in it. But
okay.
There's hardly anything in the cupboard. Well, peanut butter and banana sandwich.
Had it for breakfast today.
It's yummy.
Because there wasn't much in the house to eat.
Which
is pathetic, right? It's Ed Levine from Serious Eats. There's nothing in the house to eat.
But that's my fallback. And I actually do find it delicious. And sometimes you can drizzle a little honey on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but the chunky kind of peanut butter. So that's
good.
That's what I'm eating.
So
yeah.
It's just been declared Jenny Allen Day.
Oh, my God. How great.
All over the world.
Yeah.
What's happening on that day?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Oh, I haven't. Oh, Ed, that is a great question. All right. Well, everybody gets up and there's bacon and that day in different forms.
All right.
Bacon and eggs. And then we're going to pack some.
BLTs
and take them to the beach.
Okay.
And some Cape Cod potato chips. And we're going to, and some, yes, fruit and stuff like that, and brownies. And we're going to go to the beach on Jenny Allen Day.
Everybody all over the world will go to a beach or a park. They'll eat with people they like, and they will derive so much pleasure. And
they will have a picnic.
And I guess there'll be seconds.
And there will be seconds and thirds if you want them. Also, egg salad sandwiches.
All right. That sounds good.
Yeah.
But no macaroons?
None of those fancy macaroons. What are those? Is there...
The French. They're not macaroons.
What
Jenny,
are
they're
they?
Macarons.
Oh, that's right. Okay, they should not call them macaroons. They are not macaroons. They are some off other thing. They're okay. They're okay. But they cost like $6.95 a piece. You get all excited. Well, I did the first time. The colors are...
Not found in nature.
Not found in nature. And I love macaroons that... Well, I love the macaroons you get for Seder.
Yeah,
I
mean, that coconut macaroons dipped in dark chocolate is probably one of the best things.
The best things. Well, I think that's maybe, do you think that's perhaps where the original idea for the Mounds Bar may have come?
It's true. Sure. Maybe the inventor of the Mounds Bar was a Hasidic Jew.
I'm sure of it.
Oh, yeah. You asked me.
Oh, yeah. Who would you have?
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it's all about people... because I've been writing this book/memoir, and I realized that the people that I want to have at my Last Supper, if I can't have my wife and son and her friends, are the people that haven't been afraid to blaze their own path, and people that are trying to move things forward. You know, I think in my life, there's a wonderful saxophonist named Jimmy Heath. He's 92.
Oh.
And when I first got to New York, I produced concerts in the park, and I met Jimmy, and he ended up giving me saxophone lessons, even though I'd never picked up a saxophone. And this is one of the greatest saxophone players of all time, played with John Coltrane, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker.
Heath.
Jimmy Heath, he's 92.
Oh.
He, like many jazz musicians of his era, had been in and out of jail twice for heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was so hopeful and so devoted to his craft and his art.
Mm.
And I love that. Those are the kinds of people. So it's people like Jimmy Heath, and there are obviously lots of creative people who fit that bill, but that's what I kind of look for. And I just read that he's not feeling well, so Jimmy, if you're out there and you're hearing this, you're the man.
Wonderful.
So thank you so much for sharing a special sauce with us, Jenny Allen.
It was such an honor and a pleasure. And now again, I feel like, now I have to go home and write. This is so much more fun.
Whether you need a good laugh and or a way to feel hopeful in these troubled times, read Jenny's new book, Would Everybody Please Stop? Reflections on Life and Other Bad Ideas. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.
Ed, thank you. This is so fun.
Oh, good.
Are you kidding? Doesn't everybody love doing this?
They do.